Hello, my name's Guy Somerset, and I'm the Books and Culture Editor of the New Zealand Listener. Welcome to the latest of our Listener Book Club podcasts. This month we're talking about David Ballantyne's 1968 novel, Sydney Bridge Upside Down, which was reissued a couple of years ago by Text, and then this year put into their Text Classics series. The novel is told from the perspective of the young boy Harry Baird, and is set in Calliope. Bay, Calliope being the muse of epic poetry, which is a stand-in for Hicks Bay on the east coast of the East Cape of New Zealand, where the writer Ballantyne was actually raised himself. It's set during the course of a summer, and looming across the whole story and across the whole area in many ways is the local meatworks and the killing room thereof. And as the novel progresses, spoiler alert, this is going to be an inevitable spoiler alert issue of this podcast. I don't think we can talk about this book without spoilers. As the novel progresses, the body count mounts. With me to discuss the book this month is Michael Byrne of McLeod's Booksellers in Rotorua, Toby Buck of Unity Books in Wellington, and Gillian Newman of the University Bookshop down in Canterbury. Thanks to you all for joining me. To begin, I just wanted to talk a bit about the idea of it being the great unread New Zealand novel, which is how Patrick Evans once described it, as Kate Goldie cites in her introduction to the book. Which of you had read it before? Had any of you read it before this? Gillian?
No, I haven't, but it has been sitting on my bookshelf because my partner, Richard King, had loved it and had always told me every time we were talking about New Zealand literature, it would come up. So I had a copy, a 1980 copy, sitting on the bookshelf, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to force me to read it, because otherwise it probably would have been one of those books that, you know, oh, I've got to read that one day, you know. But I'm glad I did.
Michael and Toby? Michael.
Likewise, I enjoyed the book immensely, and no, missed it when it came out, much to my shame. I would have been like 17 or 18 at the time when it was published, and like to think that I would have known about it. Mind you, as Kate DeGoldie points out, it's been out of print for 30 years. But it was one of those books that went under everybody's radar, and I still don't know why. And it'd be interesting to know why we missed it and didn't miss Morrison and Sardison and Prime, you know.
And Toby, yourself?
Well, no, I'm very much benefited from the reprint. I hadn't even heard of the book before, actually. So it was maybe a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now, when Tex first put it back, and that was the point at which I saw it, and I was immediately attracted to it and wanted to read it. It looked great, so that was when I first saw it.
One of the other things that strikes me is that of the four of us here, Michael, I suspect you're the only native-born New Zealander. You are a native-born New Zealander, is that correct?
Indeed.
You are.
I was actually born in Gisborne.
Oh, really?
And can relate to a lot of geography, in fact. There was an old abattoir, Freezing Works, in Gisborne, and I know much of the atmosphere and the spookiness of a kind of abandoned abattoir and Freezing Works and the dangers therein. That was part of my background, and going up the coast in the summertime, surfing, we would go up to Hicks Bay, and it is indeed the edge of the world. We used to think that. You know, these funny little coincidences. And here's a book all the time that I completely missed out on. Sorry about that.
And it's a book that, I mean, you recognise that aspect of your own childhood and past. It's a book that, although it obviously plays very widely with realism and goes off in a very different direction. The writer himself, Ballantyne, called it a gothic comedy or a gothic joke at another time, although others pointed out that there wasn't that much humour in it in many respects.
I was going to say I actually struggled to find any humour, really, that apart from the boys racing around naked and smacking each other on the bottom.
That's
I can't
right.
really think of a particularly humorous element.
I think it's perhaps sort of one of those very poker face jokes. For all that gothic element of it, it struck me that Ballantyne's background was in realism, and it starts off as a very realistic novel, and the realistic aspects of it are very well drawn before it starts to move into much more psychologically murky areas. What did you think on that front, Toby?
Yeah, definitely. I am native born New Zealand. There is definitely a strong part of it that I recognise, because I grew up in Hawke's Bay, and rural New Zealand is definitely there. Strong sense of it, and that setting for the gothic twist of it do work very well. Maybe it's his background in journalism. That would obviously kind of suggest itself for his ability to kind of convey that scene so quickly and kind of sketch it out, I think, before he moves into the psychological aspect of the main character. I have to say that I did enjoy it myself. I wouldn't call it a laugh-out-loud book at all, but I think, I did enjoy reading it massively. I do find it a very enjoyable book to read.
Now, apologies.
It's obviously very dark.
Apologies, Toby. I'm accusing you of not being a New Zealander. my tin ear is playing up with me there today. I'm blaming my cold. The grounding in realism, the book then does move into these very, very dark and strange areas, and the way it does so is very gradual. It creeps up on you. It kind of reminded me of, there's a great song by Elvis Costello called Psycho, which is an old Leon Payne country song, with the narrator gradually revealing himself to be a complete and utter nutter. And that's, yeah. that's what really happens in this book. Does it work? Some of the critics at the time, Dennis McEldowney in The Listener in 69, he couldn't go into all the details of why he didn't think it necessarily added up, but he kind of hinted that if you actually looked at it, the voice that you have at the beginning of the book and the one you have at the end of the book, you can't quite see how you've got from one to the other, how the one would have been able to have narrated the early part of the book. Did you find that, Gillian?
Well, I disagree, actually. I mean, I think that in the beginning, you're meant to, it's a young, innocent, apparently innocent boy on the cusp of adult, well, and that sort of, we're never told exactly how old he is. But then at the end of the book, all these extraordinary events have occurred, and you've moved through the darkness with him, and it's a very much more mature person at the very end of the book telling the story. And I do think it has moved through. You can see how it's moving through. I do think that I disagree with Nathaniel. I think that you can believe it's the same person. You do get a shock. As Kate de Goldie says in her introduction, you read the last two paragraphs and your heart's in your mouth. You get such this incredible shock because you want it to be better than that somehow, don't you? You want the ending to be better, but you know in your heart it can't be. That this person's so damaged. I think same voice, I think.
There's that lovely kicker of the very, very last paragraph, which comes on its own page.
Yes, I found that incredible, the yearning for, and as Kate de Goldie does say herself, you sort of return to it emotionally, don't you?
Yes.
And I love Kate's description of slaughterhouse fiction. Isn't that so Kiwi? That's unique. And the social realism tag has been turned upside down too, hasn't it? I mean, some accept it and some reject it. It's hard to do social realism in fiction, but if you do, the book that comes to mind by comparison with this one is Ingleby, Sebastian Faulks. Has anybody read that?
Yes.
There's a very unreliable narrator who it becomes more unreliable and even pathological, and that is a shock. And similarly, in this book, I guess the spoiler alert has already been sounded.
Oh, no, but, yeah, don't worry, we're not going to pretend with this one.
You do find your trust in the narration of Harry starting to waver a little bit. In fact, he's not only a bully, he's responsible, isn't he, for quite a lot of what's being talked about.
Well, that's
although
right.
He maintains his own sort of integrity, his own innocence, and you only really get that looking back on it, don't you?
And which is what I was kind of saying about that very final paragraph, that, you know, the kicker of that, the kick of that, really, that, you know, he hints that he has done for Mr. Dalloway in some nefarious way on a very tall building somewhere, which is just a wonderful kind of just kick in the stomach.
Yeah. In fact, he's responsible for everybody when you think about it. And Kate Cataldi says that she reads this regularly and gets something out of it all the time. And I'm inclined to think that we need to read it again, probably, you know, after 6 months or a year, and we'll get another take on it. There's all sorts of things hidden in there, isn't there?
Sorry, go on, Gillian.
I was going to say, one of the things that, for me, is the mark of an extraordinary book, is that you can remember so much of it 6 months later. I mean, maybe that's what Kate's meaning. This is a book you're not going to forget, are you? I mean, really, it stays with you. And it's not just that the writing is good or the premise is good. It's got some other overarching, extraordinary feature. I don't know. It just stays with you. And I think that's one of the aspects that makes it so special.
And it stays with you in different ways. I mean, one scene certainly that stays with you is one of the most grotesque sex scenes, I think, that has probably been written, the merging of the murder house, the killing room, and a sex scene. And I mean, most of the grotesqueness is the kind of connections that are made in the head of Harry, the narrator himself. But that's a shocking to kind of voyeuristic look at sex, isn't it?
Well, I'm the only female on this panel, and I think that probably I have a completely different view from the three of you, but it did occur to me, I am the mother of three sons, and, you know, they went through adolescence, and I hope that they... But in any case, what I'm trying to say is I think that that's an extraordinary time in a person's life, particularly in a young boy's life. And so the voice that he's using to reenact that, which was probably his own voice, I think, that very difficult and challenging time. And so, you know, sex sort of looms over the novel, doesn't it, in many...
Yes.
It is perfectly realised in passages, yes. And I was going to ask earlier, what age do you think Harry could be? Because there's a point, of course, where you can run up and down the hall naked, unselfconsciously, but he'd need to be 10, wouldn't he, or 11?
And living in the country?
14, 15.
Well, I had him at 13.
Yeah,
I was going to say 12.
But you come back, I'm sure you come back when you think about it, he's putting one and one together, all right, but he's still unselfconscious enough to run around naked and laugh, you know, and you've got to be pretty young for that.
The other things that stand out amazingly, and you do remember, this was my second reading of it, and I read it a couple of years ago, are the characters. They're just so well drawn. I mean, we were talking about, you know, there's Caroline, the cousin, this wonderfully flirty, kind of disingenuous girl. There's so many others. I mean, you know, Mr. Dalloway himself, who just, you know, rather perhaps heavy-handedly, it's quite clear from very early on in the book that, you know, he's clearly doing much more with Harry's mum than just going to discuss his, test results or whatever. You know, Susan Prosser, Sam Phelps, Mr. Wiggins. Mr. Wiggins, reading it the second time, I was trying to think, you know, has he been quite as predatory as Harry has depicted him? When you read through the book, you think, well, maybe, you know, this is entirely Harry projecting onto him.
Well, that's my interpretation.
Yeah.
Well, whatever description you give Mr. Wiggins, he's not a very nice guy. He's a butcher.
No.
And he's a sort of a predator, and he's an opportunist, and he's way too interested in Caroline. I didn't like him.
Yeah.
No.
But even the friends, you know, Brother Cal and Dibs Kelly, or even somebody as peripheral as Buster Kelly, very deftly drawn with a few strokes in some cases.
And didn't Susan Prosser come across well? She was narrow.
Her narrow eyes.
Yes. And she was always called Susan Prosser, you know, at mostly. And yes, she sort of, you weren't that unhappy about her demise, although it was a surprise.
Reading, I don't know if any of you have read the Brian Reid biography of Ballantyne after the fireworks, but it was quite interesting to read some of the background to the book. Initially, apparently, there was a short story called Sydney Bridge Upside Down, which was never written, so we don't know quite what form it was going to take. But even more interestingly, he had plans to follow up with two subsequent novels. One,
I've heard that as well, but...
Trilogy of Harry.
Was it mentioned that it was set in Wellington?
That's right. I mean, basically, one was going to be set around the world of the occult, and it was going to kind of revolve around, there was a particular murder, I can't remember the murder case, that happened in 68, possibly, around about that time anyway. And then the third one was going to have him as, which is a wonderful commentary, perhaps, he was going to have him as a journalist, which is perhaps the only place where somebody like Harry Baird could end up with a reasonable working life. But I'm glad he didn't. I mean, it seems to be such a perfectly self-contained book. I mean, what do you think, Toby? It seems that you kind of want to imagine what's going to happen or what has happened.
Absolutely. I mean, I get the feeling that the book is just an exposition. That what we're getting at the end of the book is really the establishment of the character, the main protagonist, fully formed psychologically to continue into the next two books. And I think that fractured, unreliable narrator that we have throughout the book that is so protective of his cousin and therefore his characterizations of other people in the story are unreliable as well. You know, I think there at the end of the book, you've got that fully formed pathological sociopath, you know, there. And I think that's also what makes the book feel very contemporary, is that because you're dealing with social pathology, that there is something that people can immediately identify with still. I mean, TV shows full of, some crime TV nowadays in New Zealand, a very popular subject.
So you would have been pleased to follow on with some more novels with the character.
I would love to see a couple more novels. I did just want to jump in and say as well that it does remind me of a lot of a book called Wake and Fright by Kenneth Clark, which is an Australian novel, which is also in this series by Text, which was written at a similar time, which is about a rural kind of horror story as well, set in Australia. And also it reminds me a bit of The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks.
Ah, yes.
With that unreliable adolescent whose personality is being formed by sexuality and by violence and ritualized places as well, like the works in this novel.
Well, we always like to have tips for other books, so I, for one, am going to go and look for that Australian novel. I've already read The Wasp Factory, although a long time ago. Perhaps it's time for a reread. Thank you, all three of you, for talking about Sydney Bridge Upside Down, this month's book club choice from David Ballantyne. Next month, we are talking about NW, which is the new novel from Zadie Smith. But until then, goodbye.